charming pot.
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space. No one could have dreamed we were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of life on other planets. And yet, across the gulf of space, minds immeasurably superior to ours regarded this Earth with envious eyes. And slowly and surely, they drew their plans against us.
So begins what has been termed one of the first science fiction books ever written, The War of the Worlds, by visionary Herbert George Wells. I believe my first exposure to this story was the 1953 film Seen on a Sunday Afternoon. I remember it completely creeping me out and having nightmares about it for days afterwards. Well, now the film always brings to mind the song Science Fiction Double Feature from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but that's a segment for another day. You know, it could have been the Now Age series graphic novel from Pendulum Press that I bought while still in grade school. The graphic novel featured what I thought at the time were some pretty nifty black and white drawings. It wasn't until I read the book in its original form for the first time for this segment that I realized how different it was from the story to which I had been exposed as a child. First, a little biographical information. H.G. Wells was born on September 21st, 1866. While I won't give you a full biography of this amazing man at this point, I will tell you that to say he was a man far ahead of his time is to make one of the greatest understatements of the year. In his lifetime, he predicted spaceflight and the precursor of the World Wide Web, which he termed the World Brain. He was a supporter of the suffragette movement. He wrote about the League of Peace in 1914, which became the forerunner of the League of Nations. He was friends with Winston Churchill. He was a proponent of freedom of speech and spoke to world leaders everywhere about it. Adolf Hitler had him put on the proscribed reading list in 1933, which resulted in his books being burned and his being put on the German wanted list should the Nazis ever take England. Wells was also a contemporary of science fiction writer Jules Verne. Verne had been writing for a number of years before Wells came on the scene as an emerging writer, but hadn't begun to gain popularity until the end of the 19th century. Verne, as a matter of fact, actually held Wells in open contempt because Wells didn't do the science part of the science fiction novel. Verne was something of a purist and would do the research and the mathematical calculations to get his man to the moon, for example. Wells, on the other hand, would invent a substance that would take care of the issue without any scientific research to back it up, at which point Verne would protest, "Where's the science in that?" He didn't realize that Wells was more interested in the people who went to the moon than in the mechanics of doing it, as Verne was. Even so, the two were forever paired in history as the fathers of science fiction. While Wells' writing talents did not tend to include science in its purest form, what it did include was what some have termed remorseless logic. In other words, he would systematically plot out what technology would be most logical for the human race to have by using his well-developed powers of observation and incorporate it into his stories. In fact, some of his thought processes were later given validity by people such as Albert Einstein with his theories of time travel and the universe. Wells was a prolific writer. He wrote over 100 books, even though we mostly know him for four of his works: The Island of Dr. Moreau, The Invisible Man, The Time Machine, and The War of the Worlds. The War of the Worlds was originally published in Pearson's magazine in 1897 and then was released as a novel in 1898. The amazing thing is that it has been in continuous print ever since, which is some 100 years later. To set the stage for the possible inspiration for the story, consider what was going on in the world at the time. A meteorite enters the Earth's atmosphere and explodes over New Martinsville, West Virginia. The first telephone message from a submerged submarine was heard. President McKinley orders the blockade of Cuban harbors shortly after calling for the Spanish-American War, and scientists Pierre and Marie Curie discover radium. Collectively, these were huge, world-changing events, and they were happening with what must have been startling speed to those who lived in that time. It makes total sense that Wells would incorporate the themes of war, misuse, technology, and things falling from space into this story as an allegory of the times. For those of you who have not read the original book because you haven't gotten around to it, unlike Baker, who hasn't read it because he can't read yet, I'll give you a micro synopsis. Spoiler alerts in the offing here. War of the Worlds is set in Victorian England. The narrator is a regular guy who's married and lives in a rural part of England not far from London. Bam! Weird cylinders from Mars fall from the sky into his bucolic little hamlet. Strange, octopus-like creatures emerge, looking weak and obviously suffering from the difference in Earth's gravity and that of their own planets. The little buggers are smart, and though they're struggling against gravity, they still do a bang-up job of putting together their tripods. Think of a huge tank on three long, ground-devouring legs. The Martians proceed to destroy the countryside and its inhabitants, alternately using a heat wave and just devouring whatever humans are too slow to escape them. This reminds me that I don't have to be a fast runner, I just have to be faster than the guy behind me. Well, anyway, our mostly fearless narrator gets his wife out of town in a horse and wagon affair that he's borrowed, but heads back to town to return the rig and watch the superior British army kick some Martian butt. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back at the narrator's village, the British army is actually being schooled by the invaders. Though they've destroyed one of the tripods, they have more to deal with and they're failing miserably. Our narrator decides to hide in his house, meets an artilleryman there, loses the guy while escaping the Martians again, then runs across a low-level priest a little while later. Those two get trapped in a house and wind up detesting each other because they're stuck there for absolutely days. It must have been like the Victorian version of the surreal life reality show, but I digress. Conveniently for our narrator, the Martians' lust for human blood is satisfied by the priestly guy our narrator has bludgeoned into insensibility and left for bait, and he escapes them as they're having some novitiate nosh. Kind of reminds me of Otis and Shane in the first season of The Walking Dead. The narrator leaves the destroyed house and continues to search for his wife, discovering that the world he knew is largely smoking rubble and red Martian weed. Before you ask, Baker, no, the weed isn't smokable. Sorry. He runs across a few people from whom he was separated earlier, including his wife. He discovers that the Martians have all died, and not at the hands of the superior British forces, but at the flagella of infectious bacterium to which humans are immune. Happy endings for all, except those who have to clean up the mess. Oh, and the half-eaten dead people, too. The book version of The War of the Worlds stuck around for a long time, creating interest in various people in the entertainment industry. In 1924, an important executive at Paramount Studios, Jesse Lasky, bought the rights for The War of the Worlds from H.G. Wells. It sat there at Paramount until 1951, that's 27 years, before a film was made. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. In those intervening years, Wells' son expressed interest in doing something with the story, but Wells told him that it had been sold. A number of international film directors, including Alfred Hitchcock himself, had been kicking around the idea of making it into a film, but no one took the plunge. Wells told his son that the idea had languished for too long and that a period piece wouldn't be of interest to anybody at that point, but he was wrong. There was someone, and someone with the talent to bring it up to date. In 1938, Orson Welles, no relation to H.G., came along. With the help of the Mercury Theater, Orson Welles pulled off what might be called the most epic Halloween prank ever, even though it happened on October 30th instead of the 31st. He revamped the War of the Worlds into a radio broadcast that would cause panic all over America. Part of the reason for the panic was people doing the radio version of channel surfing while the boring part of the show that they were listening to was playing. People who didn't want to hear the singer on the Charlie McCarthy Show, a very popular radio program at the time, tuned in after Orson Welles had made the announcement that this was a story, not a real event happening in real time. It was told in the style of the day, with very realistic-sounding news flashes breaking into the broadcast and panic-sounding updates from the actors. The descriptions of the Martians were lurid for the day and terrified the bulk of listeners who tuned in late. Many were already abandoning their cars and preparing to flee their cities when Orson Welles came on at the end to clear up any misunderstandings, though many missed that part as well.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
With the success of that Halloween prank, interest in the War of the Worlds as a film was renewed. Makeup and effects giant Ray Harryhausen wanted to make it, but Cecil B. DeMille apologetically declined and gave the film to George Pal. Harryhausen was extremely disappointed, as he had already built a Martian according to H.G. Wells' description, as well as shot some tests of it in action. George Pal was the Steven Spielberg of his day. He took his screenplay of The War of the Worlds to the head of Paramount Studios, Don Hartman. Hartman didn't like science fiction or see any commercial value in it at all, and in front of Pal, he pitched the script straight into the garbage can. Pal absolutely lost it and launched himself across the desk at Hartman, apparently with every intent to strangle the man. The president of Paramount Company, Frank Freeman Sr., heard this going on and separated the two, giving Pal his assurances that he and the studio were behind him 100% in the making of the movie. Certain elements of the story were changed for the film. Instead of a regular guy as the narrator, the guy was a scientist, played by Gene Barry. Instead of introducing him as a married man, he is single, and he meets a young lady played by Anne Robinson, who goes through a number of trials and tribulations with him during the Martian invasion. I had a chance to meet and chat with Anne Robinson at last month's Monsterpalooza in Burbank, California. I have to admit, while I had already met several modern-day celebs by the time I met her at her booth, I didn't go all giddy and fangirl until I met her and realized who she was. She truly is the epitome of old-school Hollywood's graciousness and charm, and I really enjoyed spending time with her. What a great, great lady. The War of the Worlds movie was released in 1953 and was arguably the first of the science fiction film genre. It was shot in three-color Technicolor film, which gave it, in its intended format, its deeply saturated colors and also hid the wires on the Martian spacecraft. It wasn't until it was reprinted on Eastman Kodak film that the wires were revealed. It's unfortunate that most of us will never see those threatening ships without their wires, and that many kids of today will sneer at the visual effects. They really were quite advanced for their day. Can you imagine what it must have been like to see the film in 1953? There really was no CGI. There were no visual effects even coming close to what we're accustomed to today. Real, live, ugly aliens with pulsing veins and creepy tricolored eyes? Please, please do yourself a favor and go back and see this film with the time period firmly in mind. Remember that McCarthyism was in full swing and that World War II wasn't that long ago, and you'll see the story with new eyes. You won't be sorry. Through the years, the story continued to capture the imaginations of an amazing variety of people. This included Jeff Wayne, a musician, who wrote the spectacular War of the Worlds double album in 1978. This concept album brought the story to a new generation of people who didn't necessarily think of themselves as science fiction fans. He won a number of awards for it, and as recently as last year, Wayne was touring with a live orchestra performing the album. More years passed, and the War of the Worlds was recycled into the Will Smith vehicle Independence Day, giving a modern-day spin to the bacterial demise of the aliens. It very likely inspired the invasion of the Body Snatchers of 1956, as well as the Mars Attacks Topps trading cards. It paved the way for science fiction movies, books, and graphic novels as we enjoy them today. I am, by the way, ignoring the Tom Cruise version of The War of the Worlds because I feel it was too much of an ode to Cruise's ego and depended too much on over-the-top CG to tell the story. Sorry, Tom. Even Scientology couldn't save you from this one. Oh, and before I forget, please be sure to check the HauntCast website as I'll be putting up a post with some links to various War of the Worlds grooviness. That's if Baker remembers to publish it, of course. The War of the Worlds is a timeless kind of story, as are all the great, enduring tales of humankind. It reminds us that the Earth that sustains us is only a hair's breadth away from being destroyed by mechanical, remorseless, and unsympathetic forces. Those forces start with alien eyes staring at Earth with enough covetousness and greed to launch them across millions of miles of space to invade our homes. It shows us the dangers of us versus them. It reminds us that it wouldn't take much for us to drop back down a few notches on the food chain, because we really aren't all that in a bag of chips. We just haven't been introduced to the predator who can send us back into our caves as a species. Not yet. But one day, they will come. Meanwhile, they are watching us. Waiting. Planning. Keep your eyes on the night skies, my darklings. Good night, and bloody kisses.
I'm going now. Heaven help you.
Please like and follow the podcast. Stalk us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Links in the description. And help us by sharing Hauntcast with all your haunt and Halloween brethren. Until next time, stay scary.